You know, one thing that we never seem to run short of in this life is advice. People are always willing to give it. And if you are not sure about something, if you're not sure about how things should go or what should be done, you just ask somebody and they'll generally tell you. And a lot of times when you're talking to someone about a thing that you're involved with, something you're doing, well, they know something about that too. And they might know a better way to help you to do that. And we're always eager to tell other people about the better way. I don't think that's all bad. I think it's good to want to help people. The song that we just sang a few moments ago, A Beautiful Life, in that song it talks about helping others. And one of the ways that we can help other people is by showing them a better way. A lot of time through experience, we've gone through something, we've figured out the pitfalls, we made mistakes along the way, and so we want to help others to avoid those things, and we want to keep them from making the same mistakes, and so we'll offer that advice. Well, here's something maybe you should try. Here's a better way to do that. Well, as we've been looking at the book of Ecclesiastes, we've seen that there are two different perspectives in this life. There's the life under the sun, and then there's life, if we could call it, above the sun. That is, that there are those who only have a view of this life, and then there are those who have a view and a perspective of God. We might call it the godly or the ungodly view, the secularist view. That is, one who just all that's here is all that's here. And there is nothing beyond this, as opposed to the one who recognizes that we are created by God, that there will be a judgment, and that we are responsible for this life in which we live so that we can make preparation for the life to come. As we've been going through and looking at some things, I want to ask myself this question, as well as you all, and that is, how is your eyesight? How is your vision? How are you seeing things today? I think as I've been studying through the book of Ecclesiastes for the last several months, I hope my eyesight's gotten a little bit better. I've tried to get it a little better, to see things a little differently maybe than I have in the past. There's some things in the book of Ecclesiastes that I'll tell you, I don't quite have a good grasp on it. That is, I couldn't just take these verses and say, this is exactly what God intended when he inspired Solomon to write these things down. I like for things to be nice and simple. I like for them to fit in a nice, neat little pattern. And while I think a lot of the book lends itself to a pattern, to something we can look, and it doesn't always fit that way. And some of what we're going to look at tonight, there were a couple of verses that I thought, you know, I wish these verses would have said something a little bit different because that would have fit my pattern a little bit better. But as much as I tried to read something different into those verses, I just couldn't come up with it. And so I can't keep that pattern. But that just shows me that I don't know everything. And I need to have a trust in God and a recognition that God knows what he's doing, and not try to force his hand to fit my need. But as we go through tonight, I want us to really keep this in mind, this idea of the view that we see things through, either life here on this earth and that's it, or a life with God in view, with eternity in view. Because there's some things in this section that I think we could just look at. If we just took them out and looked at them, that's true. That's true. Somebody say, this is how it is. Yeah, that's how it is. Through my experience and through my understanding, I'd say that's true. But when we have eternity in view, we'll find that while it might be true about life in general, maybe it's not the outlook that we as Christians ought to have. We're going to try, hopefully each day, to get better and better, to improve. The book of Ecclesiastes will help us in that. The section we're going to look at tonight, chapters 4 through 7, the word that comes up again and again is better. And so we're going to talk about a better life, a better way. And we're going to find that as we go through, there are some suggestions offered as to what is better. But our challenge is to see, is it really better? Or is that just what the world would say is better? And join with me now as we look at some examples. And as we go through, I think you'll get more of a better understanding of what we're talking about. I think this really stems, this entire section that we're going to look at, 4 through 7, I think it stems from what we looked at last week when looking in beginning verse 19 of chapter 3, it says, "For what happens to the sons of men also happens to animals. One thing befalls them, as one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all are from the dust, and all return to the dust. Who knows the spirit of the sons of men, which goes upward, and the spirit of the animal, which goes down to the earth? So I perceive that nothing is better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him?" So there in verse 22, drawing on the conclusion that really man is no better than the animals, they all die, and we don't know what happens after that. So the conclusion then is it's better that man should just rejoice in his own works, for this is his heritage. So just do what you can do in this life. Work, get all that you can get. Enjoy that, because that's it. And that's what's better. Well, I don't think I have to do much convincing to tell you that that's not better. Solomon here is not writing some great spiritual truth in verse 22 to say it's better that we should just work and rejoice in those works. Now, if it is true that when we die, we don't know what happens, we're just dead, just like Rover, we're dead, well then, yeah, let's work, do what we can. But that's not the conclusion. That's not the end of the matter with man. So I think what we're going to find in chapters 4, 5, and 6 primarily are some more of this type of reasoning, that this is it. This world's all we got. And so let's look at some things that are better. Here's what man ought to give himself to. Like I said, I wish that some of these verses would have fit a little bit better into this layout. But there are a few, I think, where he stops and shows us, no, something that truly is better. Something that from the Lord is better. Not just based on these passages, but even based on some other things we're reading in Scripture. Well, let's start in chapter 4. I'm not going to reread what Jonathan read. I appreciate him reading through chapter 4. But as we look at the first three verses, he speaks of those who are oppressed, those who have no comforter there in verse 1. In verse 2, here's the conclusion. Because there's no comforter, because you see the oppression and the problems of this earth, then he praises the dead who are already dead, more than the living who are alive. They're free from all of the trouble and the strife and the misery of this life. And then in verse 3, well, I'll tell you what's better than that. It's better if you'd never been born, never to have to experience any of these things. I tell you, that's not the godly view. That's not what God would say is better. Now, verse 1, when he talks about the oppression, the fact that there is no comfort, that problem is a real problem. We can look around us and see that everywhere. That there's injustice, there's oppression, there's mourning, and there just doesn't seem to be any solution to the problem. Whether you're talking about some disease or just some injustice done by some government somewhere, and it just continues on and on and on, and we see there's no answer to it. Well, if you're just looking at this life, well, then you might come to the conclusions he draws in verses 2 and 3. It'd be better to be dead than to live in a place like this. I tell you what'd be better than that, never to be born. But again, that's the view without God in view. In verse 4, again, I saw that for all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. You work hard in life. You make something of yourself and for yourself, and you've got some things, and what do you get for it? Envious neighbors, people who look across the fence and hate you because you've been successful. You know, that's what a man gets for all of his labor in this life. And well, then you've got the other side of it. One sees that and he says, well, if that's all you get, well, I'm just going to fold my hands up. I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to be poor. There was a story told of a young man who he saw the what we call the rat race out there, everybody trying to keep up with the Joneses. He didn't want to have any part with that. And so he told his father, he said, I'm not going to go to college. I'm not going to try to make a career for myself. I don't want all of that. I want out of that. I want to be poor. And his father told him, he said, being poor is not fun. I've been there. And it's not something you're going to enjoy. But that seems to be the opposite. You know, verse 4, you make something of yourself and people are envious. Well, verse 5, well, I'm just not going to do anything. He folds his hands. He has nothing. So what's he going to do? He consumes his own flesh. Well, then in verse 6, and I think this is the truth. This is something that I think is going to come up again and again through the reading. Better a handful with quietness than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind. You know, there's somewhere in the middle between the riches of this world and heaping up the treasures of this world and just being poor as dirt. Well, why not just have something there in the middle? You know, to have a little bit with quietness. And the word that we're going to see again and again is actually not used specifically, but I think the idea is there throughout the passages we're going to look at is contentment. To be content. You know, that's what's better. You know, man has ideas about what's better. But true contentment is better than either of those things. It's better than toiling and grasping for the wind, something that you can't hold on to, something that will bring no lasting joy. And then in verse 7, I returned and saw vanity under the sun. There's our word vanity again, you know, things just empty and worthless. There's one alone without companion. He has neither son or brother, yet there is no end to all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. And so you've got this man who maybe he has some things in life, maybe he has some success, but he has no one to share those blessings with. Well, the conclusion here is, well, in verse 9, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. I think there is some truth to that. I think that's scriptural. That's that we can have that view with God in view. In Genesis chapter 2, when God saw the man was alone, he said that's not good. And he made him a helper comparable to him, a companion. And so, yeah, I believe it is better to have two than have one alone. And he gives some good reasons. If they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. And can't we see the truthfulness of that in the spiritual realm? That God didn't just save us from our sins and send us back out in the world to be scattered among the people of the world. He saved us from our sins and he had us to gather together, to work together as brothers and sisters in Christ, to help one another, to edify and build up one another. If two lie down together, they'll keep warm, but how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him in a threefold cord is not quickly broken. So what's better than two? Three. There's strength in numbers, and that is a truth that we do well to learn. We don't have to go through this life alone. We have help. The people of this world, without God, they truly are alone. And when people get down and discouraged, and they feel alone, without God, that emptiness and that aloneness, it is just magnified. Because they truly are by themselves. But you think about someone who has God. Paul wrote to Timothy and talked about how everyone had forsaken him. No one stood with him in his defense, but God did. And so even as a Christian, even when we might feel all alone, we're not. We're truly not, and we can know that God is with us and that there are others, even if they're not right with us, present physically, they're still with us. When Elijah felt like he was all alone, and he goes to the mountain and he asks the Lord, just take his life, for I alone am left. Well, what God reminded him of was, number one, you got work to do, and so get busy. I'm still here, I'm still with you, and I'm going to help you in this work. But at the very end, he's, no, you're not alone. There are 7,000 who've not bowed the knee to Baal. And so we should understand the value of having others who are working with us. And with God, we will always have that companion that will help us. Then you come to verse 13, better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. Now here's a passage that to me was a bit of a challenge. And I'll tell you, you know, if you have some different view, a different understanding, a different idea that that you would like to share, you know, feel free to share that with me. But consider this. Verse 13 by itself seems to be truthful. And when I'm saying truthful here, I'm not talking about just under the sun truthful. It seems to be something that God would condone, endorse. A poor and wise youth. You know, to be poor is not all that bad if you have wisdom to go along with it. And an old and foolish king, you know, this king, he's not poor. He's rich, he's powerful. But he's foolish. You look at that, well, yeah, that seems right. But then you keep reading, and he says, for he comes out of prison to be king, although he was born in his kingdom. And I saw all the living who walk under the sun, they were with the second youth who stands in his place. There was no end of the people over whom he was made king, yet those who come after will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. So even the world might recognize that this poor and wise youth is better than this old wise king. And don't we celebrate the youth and the strength and the energy and all that they can bring. And so we raise them up. But you know what happens to that youth? He gets old. And he gets old, and then there comes along somebody else that's better and more energetic and can do things even better. But you know what happens to him? He gets old. And it's just an endless cycle. And so while I could see some truthfulness in verse 13, the picture that's painted, I think, there in verses 13 through 16 is there's just this endless cycle of, yeah, youth is great, but then what happens when you get old? Well, somebody else comes along and takes your place. And then somebody else comes along and takes your place, which is why I think he comes to the conclusion there. Surely this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. We need to enjoy our youth. We need to put the youth that we have among us to work and use all that we can. But don't think that youth is it. Don't think that they've got it and us old people, we're just decrepit and miserable and we ought to just go ahead and die. No, there's value in everyone if we will serve God and if we will do His will. I think about sometimes you watch these sports programs, whatever the sport is, and you'll have one of the greats in the stands. And it's happened several times that I've seen one of those greats there who holds a record. And in this game, you know, this young guy, he's looking to break that record, and oftentimes he does. And you think about the older fellow, when he broke that record, when he set that record, boy, he was on top. He was the king of the world. But there's always going to come somebody along that's going to break that record. And I think that's sort of the idea that we see here. That yeah, you've got this young guy, and he can do a lot, but one day he's going to be old too. And so let's just continue to serve God throughout our lives. As he comes to chapter 5 there, verse 1, walk prudently when you go to the house of God and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they do evil. As we've been looking at chapter 4, the injustice, the disappointment, the pointless effort that seems to be put out there, now we come to religion. We come to the worship of God. And he's going to show us here in these first 7 verses that even in religion, we can see emptiness and vain effort. He goes on there to say in verses 2 through 3, do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God, for God is in heaven and you on earth. Therefore, let your words be few, for a dream comes through much activity, and a fool's voice is known by his many words. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words, there is also vanity, but fear God. I think here we have a picture of religion that is all talk and there's no action. We mentioned before, we sing a lot of songs that make some lofty statements. All to Jesus I surrender. All to Him I freely give. But do we? Oftentimes we'll have the Lord's Supper and we'll sing a song about how we're dedicating, I'm going to give Him my life and my all. Everything's given to God. But you know what? I'm partaking of the Lord's Supper at another time because I didn't give Him my all that morning. Because I was tired and I decided to sleep in. Because I didn't feel like coming and being with the saints. But tonight I'm going to vow that I'm going to give God my all. You know, we need to be careful. It was described by one fellow, this empty and vain religion, as a mile wide and an inch deep. Boy, it looks good. It looks like there's just so much there and we've just got everything going, but there's just nothing to it. It's shallow. It's empty. And the conclusion there in verse 5 is better not to vow than to vow and not pay. And I tell you what's better than that. To vow and to pay it. You know, I think the end of verse 5, just don't commit to anything. Don't. Now, this is one of the verses that I wouldn't contend that there isn't some good truth here that we should learn as Christians. You look at Jephthah, somebody like him, and realize, you know, there are things we just don't need to vow. You know, he just shouldn't have said, I'm going to give whatever comes out of my house. That was a rash vow. And so maybe there's a connection there. But I think maybe the idea there in verse 5 is just don't commit. You know, if you just don't give yourself, don't say something to God like, I'm going to give you everything and then not give it. Well, what good is that going to do us? If we don't give God everything, we might as well give Him nothing. But let's commit to being truthful with God. And let's try not to be shallow. Let's try not to be one who says a lot of great swelling things, but just doesn't follow that up with actions. He goes on there in verses 8 and 9. If you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter. For high official watches over high official and higher officials over them. Moreover, the profit of the land is for all. Even the king is served from the field. And those are two verses that I don't know everything about them. I wouldn't pretend to say this is all that there is to this. But maybe there's just the idea there that we need to trust in God and know that God is in control. When he speaks of higher officials over higher officials, we know who the highest official is. And that's God Almighty. And to recognize that in this world, even the highest official, even the king is served from the field, he's still dependent on things here in this life. God is not. God isn't dependent on us for anything. And let's worship and serve him. Verse 10, he who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. There is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun, riches kept to their owners, kept for their owner to his hurt. But those riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came. And he shall take nothing from his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. And this also is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind? All his days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. And in that reading, there are a few things that we look at and say, well, that's true. As he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return there as he came in verse 15. That's true. Job said that. But look at the difference between what is said here and what is said by Job in Job chapter 1. Here you have in verse 16, and this also is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind? You look at that, and then if you'd like, you can turn back with me, or I'll read it here. In Job chapter 1, in verse 21, after Job has lost everything, he tears his robe in verse 20, shaves his head, he fell to the ground and worshiped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord. You see a difference in the attitude? Here in Ecclesiastes, this is an evil. It shouldn't be this way, that we come empty and we leave empty. You know, maybe they think that we should come and heap up all that we can and be able to just keep that with us always. Well, Job recognized, no, we don't need to keep that with us. The Lord gave it. The Lord took it away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. But here it seems you've got one who recognizes that riches are not going to satisfy those who are looking for satisfaction in the riches. You think about, and we, at that point, at this point, we might look to the wealthiest people of the world and think, that's right. They just clamor for more and more, and they're never satisfied. But for those who are married, those who've lived a little bit of a life, you think about where you started out. Where you started out in your job, how much money you had, the house you lived in. You know, we first got married, we lived in my dad's house. We didn't have much. I couldn't afford much. And, you know, as time goes on, you know, we've gotten a lot more. We've been blessed. But I look at where I'm at now, and I think most everybody here would be in very much the same boat. You know, we have grown, we prospered, we've gained. But where are we at? We're still wanting a little bit more. If there was just a little more, then I would just be set. But then you get a little bit more, and you know what we do? We get a little bit more. You know, we buy a little bit more, and then we need a little bit more. And there's just this constant growing. I knew of some folks who lived in a very modest house and drove very modest type cars. And there were brethren that actually kind of looked down on them for their conditions. And it was almost like, that's kind of an embarrassment to us because of the way they and what they're saying, they could afford more, they could do more. And I said, why don't they? I think the answer is because they were content. And they weren't willing to join in that race with everybody else to see how much they could get. So I'm not trying to condemn us all. I'm just saying we need to be careful not to just look at the rich, rich people of the world and say, yes, that's them. You know, this could hit a lot closer to home than we might think. One fellow said, the more things I possess, the more things possess me. And I think that's probably a pretty valuable statement to remember. Well, then, in verse 18, I think here you have almost like an oasis, a little place where we can just stop and see some real truths from God. Here's what I have seen. It's good and fitting for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor, which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and has given him the power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. And so we need to understand that. You know, coming out of this previous passage, we might think, well, we just need to get rid of all of the worldly things we've got and just live as a poor man. Well, no, we've already discussed that. That's not going to help us. I think what we have in verses 18 through 20, again, is a picture of contentment, to be willing to and able to enjoy what God has given us while we have it. We may not have it long. There may come another time when we're poor and we're suffering. Paul says in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 12, I know how to be abased, I know how to abound, to suffer and be in need. But he says, I've learned in verse 11, in every state to be content. And we need to learn that. And we need to learn how to enjoy the things that God has given us. And that's going to, it's already come up, it was chapter 2. I think we'll see it again in several other passages as we go through. But look at the difference. And this is a place where somebody said, well, Solomon's just crazy because he just keeps going back and forth and contradicting himself. Because in verse 19, he speaks of a man that God has given riches and wealth and given him the power to eat of it. And then you come to chapter 6, he speaks of this evil under the sun. What is this evil? Well, in verse 2, a man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that he lacks nothing for himself of all the desires, yet God does not give him the power to eat of it. So here God has given a man wealth and riches, and he's given him the power to eat of it. And over here, he's got a man that he's given wealth and riches, and he doesn't give him the power to eat of it. Is he going to have a short life? No. He says in verse 3, if a man begets 100 children, lives many years, so the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness, or indeed he has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better than he. So it's not that his life is just cut short, he can't enjoy it. When you look at the picture there in verses 10 through 17, this one who is just continuing to build and to build, and he's just never satisfied. Well, I think that's the picture of the man here in chapter 6, verses 2 and 3. It doesn't give him the power to eat of. Doesn't give him the power to enjoy it. I don't know that it's so much that he can't use it. He can't enjoy it. The man in chapter 5, verses 18 through 20, he can enjoy what God has given him because he's content. And he'll enjoy it now, and if it's not there, he won't have it, but he's not going to be bitter. But this man in the beginning of chapter 6, I think he's got the riches. He just doesn't have the ability to enjoy it. And that life is described as one lived in vain. In verse 4, for it comes in vanity, it departs in darkness, and his name is covered with darkness. Though it has not seen the sun or known anything, this has more rest than the man. Even if he lives 1,000 years twice, but has not seen goodness, do not all go to one place. And so here I think there's a stark contrast. There's no contradiction. The conflict is the person at the end of chapter 5 has God. And as Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 6, I believe it's in verse 6, godliness with contentment is great gain. And in chapter 6, you've got a man who's not godly and he's not content. He's just miserable. And so you talk to people like, well, what's better? Well, you know, get everything you can get in this life. That's better. No, it's not better. It just brings pain. It brings misery. You come to the end of chapter 6 and there's a question that's asked in verse 12. For who knows what is good for man in life? All the days of his vain life in which he passes like a shadow, who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? And it's almost a question that seems to have no answer. Who knows what's good for man? In verse 11, back up just a little bit, since there are many things that increase vanity, how is man the better? You know, what truly is better? Is there anything good for man? And then you come to chapter 7, and I think here's where God steps in. Here's where he begins to show, I can tell you what's better. In verse 1, a good name is better than precious ointment. You know, there are some who, they don't care who they step on, they don't care what they have to do to get it, they just want the riches, the power, the glory, and they're not worried about the reputation. Well, the person who believes in God is worried about the reputation, not because so much of what everybody else thinks about him, but because he's going to be judged. He knows there's a judgment to come. And so a good name is very important to us. The day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. No, to many that might seem strange. And I think when we look at the world at large, people don't believe that. You know, we scratch and we claw and we're going to hold on to this life just as long as we can. And don't tell me that I might be cut short. Well, do we understand the day of death is better than the day of our birth? I know it's cliche, but you know, for the child of God, you're just starting. You're just starting an eternal life. I was talking to Ronnie before he went into surgery, and he was talking about this tube they were going to have to put down his throat. And he said in that tube, they were going to be able to administer the medicine. They were going to be able to administer the air for him to breathe. But that was his lifeline. And so I jokingly said to him, I said, so you're saying the only thing that stands between you and heaven is that tube? And he kind of laughed and said, yeah. You know, we think about that tube. That's all that stands between me and death. That's all that stands between you and the Lord. I'm not saying pull the tube out. I don't think that's what we're reading here. You know, use this life. Be thankful for the health that God has given us. But understand that the day of our death is something that is better for, again, those who are God's. Verse 2, better to go to the house of mourning. That's better. We have a lot of parties. We have a lot of feasts. We have a lot of good times of rejoicing. And those things are fun. But God says it's better to go to the house of mourning. Why? Because that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. It's a moment of reflection. It's a moment to remind us one day we're going to be in that coffin. One day they're going to be talking about me. And so what do I do now to prepare for that day? Verse 3, sorrow is better than laughter. That wouldn't be advice that we give somebody, would it? But again, the idea of making us consider, making us thoughtful. If we just, laughter is good. I think God gave us laughter as a blessing, but if we go through this life laughing all the way, we're going to miss some things. And we're going to leave a lot of things undone. And he tells us the reason there. By a sad countenance, the heart is made better. In verse 5, it's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. For like the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. And the thing that I think he's speaking of is vanity there, the crackling of thorns, the song of fools. People go around and they'll sing your praises and they'll tell you all a good thing, pat you on the back, but that's all worthless. It's not going to do much to help you in any real way. The only thing, there's room for encouragement. There's room for helping someone to grow. But there's also the danger of causing someone to be prideful. We all like to hear good things, but we all need to hear the rebuke of the wise. Heard of a young man, and this is a true story. I don't even remember all the details for where he's from, but I heard of a young man who was just very gifted, good song leader, a good speaker, just seemed to be so far ahead of his young age and his ability. And there was a visiting preacher came in, and he was observing how good this young man, but he saw something lacking in this man. And in talking to others, he heard people talking all these praises. Oh, he can do this and he can do that. And the one praise that he never heard given to the young man was that he's humble. And sometimes you get a young man like that, and all you do is tell him how great he is, and one day he might believe it. And so we need to be careful that not only we are willing to listen to the rebuke of the wise, but that we're not this song of the fool, that we're not this crackling fire, that we're always just this yes man. Now, please don't misunderstand. Let's encourage you young fellas. We want to encourage you and let you know you do a good job, but don't let it go to your head. And let's not be guilty of that. It's better to have the rebuke of the wise. The end of a thing is better in verse 8 than its beginning. You know, that's one that he goes on, the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. I think really those work together. I don't think we often recognize that the end of a thing is better because we don't know how it's going to turn out. We don't know what the end is going to be like. And maybe there's a lesson here in contentment and trust in God, that if we're following His ways, then the end is going to be better. We might not know where the end is. We might not know where that leads. But we know it's better because we're following the Lord's ways. And there are going to be some things that come along that maybe we have to endure and suffer, but we're patient with that. And the proud in spirit, I think the proud in spirit would contrast the one who looks to the end and recognizes that God has a plan that's going to be worked out. We try to take control. We try to steer the thing. We try to determine what the end is going to be, where the Lord just wants us to be patient. The Lord wants us to trust in Him and see that end. In verse 10, do not say, why were the former days better than these? For you do not inquire wisely concerning this. Do you know, with few exceptions, as I look back through history and hear people talk about the old days, you know, it was always better. It was always better in the past. And I look back, and even in my relatively young life, I look back at things in my youth, I think, well, that was better back there. It was a simpler time. There were better people. And the further we get away from, it was just always better. But what he's saying here, don't live in the past. It's not better to do. Maybe those days were better, but it's certainly not better for us today to just sit back and bemoan the fact that things are just getting worse and worse and worse, and I wish it was like it was back then. That's not going to change anything. It's better to live right now where we are and do the best with what we have rather than just sitting back and wondering, well, why isn't God doing something about this? Why didn't God bring us back to those former times? In verse 11, wisdom is good with an inheritance and profitable to those who see the sun. For wisdom is a defense as money is a defense. But the excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it. There's been a lot said in the book of Ecclesiastes about riches, about the things of this world. And there's a lot been said about the fact that shouldn't be our main concern. That shouldn't be our focus. That shouldn't be where we put our trust and our hope. But it's not all evil. Money in itself is not bad. And what he says here in verse 11 is that if you have wisdom with an inheritance, that's better. To be able to know how to use that which the Lord has blessed us with, to be able to rightly use that, to have the excellent knowledge of wisdom that go along with the money, then both of them can help us. Wisdom is a defense, he said, but money is a defense, and that's right. When you have it, it is. And then he says it's better to enjoy the good of life and in the day of adversity, consider. In verse 14, in the day of prosperity, be joyful. You know, enjoy what we have. Enjoy the good that God has blessed us with. But when we face that adversity, you know, consider. You know, don't just think that everything's lost, that we've been forsaken. You know, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so the man can find out nothing that will come after him. When you think about contentment is not just passively sitting back. You got a picture of someone who's going through a tough time. He maybe he's lost some things. He lost his health, lost money, whatever. He's going through, and he's just sitting there, and he's just gritting his teeth, thinking, I just got to hold out. I just got to hold out. That's not contentment. Contentment is active. It grows. It rejoices with what we have, and it seeks to do with what we have the very best that we can do. And so, with all that's being said in the book about vanity and grasping for the wind, we need to understand that with God in view, there's nothing that we'll do as a child of God in His service that is vain. Maybe we don't have much right now. Maybe in our health condition, there's not a whole lot we can do. But that doesn't mean that we just sit back and do nothing. We use what we have. If we're richly blessed, then we do all that we possibly can. If we're suffering, we still do all that we possibly can. You look at the Apostle Paul, when he talked about in whatever state he was content. When he was a free man, he went all over the world preaching the gospel. When he was a prisoner, he preached the gospel to everybody he could reach. Whatever state he was in, not only was he just satisfied, but he did what he could do. And so let us do that as well. People are always happy to tell you what's better, but God knows what is better. And I think chapter 7 there, these first 13, 14 verses here will help us to see. And what the whole book is going to show us and what it is showing us is the godly life is a better life. If you're not a child of God, not living that godly life, then you're well acquainted with the misery and the grief and the toil that's mentioned in the book over and over again. But you don't have to be. You could come out of that and you can have the joy and the happiness that comes not as a result of what we have in this life, but as a result of the hope that we have for a future life with God. And if we can help you to have that peace and that joy, that true happiness that comes from God, would you come and let us know how we might help you while together we stand and sing.